Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Today we're taking a look at something fundamental, geography. Specifically, how mountains have really shaped things in the Middle East.
Right, not just the landscape, but history, culture, societies, everything, really, up to around 2010.
Exactly. We're drawing on an academic paper, The Enduring Bastions, which digs into how these massive landforms were much more than just backdrops.
So they influenced settlements, languages, empires, even beliefs. It's quite a scope.
It really is. They were active players, you could say.
Okay, let's start with the basics. When we say Middle East for this discussion, what areas are we actually talking about? The term itself can be a bit slippery.
That's true. It's a Western term originally, and the definitions varied. But for our purposes today, think Arabian Peninsula, the Levant.
So Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine.
Yeah, plus Turkey, Egypt, Iran, and Iraq. They all share these deep historical links, and crucially, mountains have played a huge role in all of them.
And we're talking major ranges, right? Which ones are key for this story?
We'll focus mainly on the big ones. The Zagros, the Taurus, the Elburz, the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges, the Sarawat down in Arabia, and the Pontic Mountains up near the Black Sea.
Okay.
And the crucial point is these aren't just static lumps of rock. Their formation, their geology, it dictated resources, climate, pathways, basically the stage for history.
How did they actually form? Our source mentions tectonic plates.
That's a huge part of it. Ranges like the Zagros, the Taurus, Lebanon, they're mostly the result of massive collisions. Think the Arabian plate hitting the Eurasian plate.
Wow, so that pushes everything up.
Exactly. Uplift, folding. You get features like limestone formations, which are important for water, but also seismic activity. It's an active process.
And volcanoes, too, sometimes.
Yeah, places like the Elburz and Sarawat have volcanic origins involved, too. So this geology isn't just background, it sets the scene.
So the main idea, the thesis from our source, is that mountains were absolutely pivotal.
Foundational, even. Shaping history, culture, society, economy, politics, spirituality. The works. Everything up to 2010.
Let's dig into that. How did they shape where people first settled? The source mentions cradles of civilization.
Well, think about what early farmers needed. Water, obviously. Protection. Land that wasn't too harsh.
And mountains offered that. In the foothills and valleys.
Precisely. You get reliable water running down, diverse little microclimates, perfect for early crops, and naturally defensible spots. It just made sense for early settlements.
The Zagros Mountains seem like a prime example here.
Oh, absolutely. We've got evidence of really early agriculture there, going back maybe 11,000 years, places like Jarmo.
Jarmo, right? And even earlier human presence.
Yes. Neanderthal remains in Shanidar Cave, also in the Zagros. It shows long-term occupation and key crops like wheat and barley. Their wild ancestors are strongly linked to these mountain zones in Turkey and the Zagros.
It's amazing that the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, depended on rivers that actually started in these mountains.
It really is. The Tigris and Euphrates, the lifeblood of Sumerian civilization, their headwaters are in the Taurus Mountains.
So the mountains are feeding the plains, essentially.
They are. The snowmelt, the rain captured in the Taurus Highlands. That's what provided the silt and the irrigation water for those first cities, a direct link.
But mountains don't just bring people together, do they? They also separate them. The source talks about isolation.
Yeah, and that's just as important. The ruggedness, the difficulty of travel, it limited contact between different mountain communities and between mountain folks and lowland folks.
And that leads to diversity.
Exactly. Cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, even genetic diversity. These areas become like islands, preserving unique traditions, languages, ways of life.
The Zagros, again, seem like a good case study for this.
Definitely. You have Kurds, Lurs, Bakhtiari, Assyrians, all living in relatively close proximity but maintaining distinct languages and cultures shaped by that mountain environment.
And genetics back this up.
Some studies suggest that, yeah. Showing connections, say, between Iraqi Kurds and other groups on the Iranian plateau, another mountainous area, more than closer lowland groups. It highlights that isolating effect.
Did this apply way back in antiquity, too? Protecting older languages.
It seems so. The ancient Near East was incredibly diverse linguistically. Mountains probably sheltered languages like Hurrian or Elamite, mostly associated with the Zagros, letting them survive longer than maybe they would have otherwise.
So barriers, but not total barriers.
Yeah.
Because there were always paths through, right? Mountain passes.
Crucial pathways. They became vital trade routes, migration corridors, even invasion routes.
So controlling them was a huge deal.
Absolutely. For trade, for defense. Controlling the passes was strategically vital. The Zagros had routes connecting Mesopotamia and the Iranian plateau. We see evidence like Roman roads, interactions with Elamites, Kassites, even really early migrations like the Kura-Araxes culture likely used Zagros routes.
And then the Taurus Mountains had a really famous one, the Cilician Gates.
Ah, the Cilician Gates. Hugely important. A major artery between Anatolia and the Levant for millennia. Hittites, Greeks, Persians, Romans, Crusaders, they all used it.
You can see why it would be heavily fortified.
And it was. Places like Umuktepe guarded the approach way back in the Neolithic. That tells you how long it's been significant.
What about other ranges? The Elburz and Sarawak.
The Elburz connected to the Silk Road network through places like Bandar Turkmen, very important for trade with Central Asia, and the Sarawak Mountains down in Arabia. That was part of the ancient frankincense route.
Frankincense, wow. Yeah.
And later, the Yemeni Hajj route to Mecca use those same mountain paths. So long-term importance for trade and religion.
Even further north, the Caucasus. Critical passes there, too.
Definitely. The Dariel and Durban passes. Gateways for people coming off the steppes and for trade. The Sasanians knew their value. They built massive fortifications at Durban to control movement.
And the Pontic Mountains. Along the Black Sea.
Maybe more isolating overall, but there were coastal routes tied into Black Sea trade networks. So even there, connections existed.
Okay. Beyond pathways, mountains also acted as refuges. Sanctuaries, the source calls them.
Yes, this is a really key role. The difficult terrain offered protection for minority groups, people facing persecution. It allowed them to preserve their culture, their religion, some autonomy.
The Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon Mountains are classic examples.
Absolutely. Long-standing refuges for Maronite Christians and the Druze. The Druze especially chose high, defensible spots. It led eventually to Mount Lebanon getting special semi-autonomous status in the Ottoman Empire. The geography made it possible.
And the Zagros, again, refuge for Kurds and Assyrian Christians.
Consistently, yes. Throughout history, during periods of conflict, the mountains provided that vital space to survive and resist assimilation or outright attack.
Does this pattern hold elsewhere? Taurus? Pontic? Elburz?
It seems to. The Taurus likely sheltered various groups, maybe Yoricks, early Christians. The Pontic Mountains were crucial for Pontic Greeks, helping them preserve their language and faith, slowing down Islamization. They even used them to escape during the violence around World War I.
And the Elburz, the assassins.
The Nizari Ismailis, yes. Their mountain fortresses, like Alamut, were incredibly effective strongholds, allowing them to operate almost independently for a long time.
Even the Sarawak in Arabia offered some safety.
It seems so. You see these 19th century hanging villages built in incredibly inaccessible spots, likely to avoid Ottoman raids. And of course, the Sinjar Mountains for the Yazidi community, a spiritual homeland and a historical refuge.
But refuge isn't just hiding. Mountains offer military advantages too, right? The strategic high ground.
Oh, absolutely. Natural observation posts, difficult terrain for attackers, choke points at passes. It favors defenders.
Leading to specific types of defenses and warfare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mountain warfare tactics, sophisticated fortifications built into the landscape. The Zagros, for example, acted as a natural barrier for Iranian empires. Controlling the passes was key for moving troops. Even in the Iran-Iraq War, that terrain really hampered Iraqi advances.
And the Cilician Gates, again, its military value is obvious.
Hugely. Fortified for millennia. Think of Termessos. High in the Tauruses, it even repelled Alexander the Great because of its position. Later Armenian kingdoms built fortresses there, too.
Alamut in the Elburz wasn't just a refuge then, it was a strategic base.
Definitely. It allowed the Nizaris to project power and resist much larger forces. Yeah. And control of cities like Rey at the junction of routes around the Elburz and Zagros shows the broader strategic importance.
The Sasanians building huge defenses in the Caucasus makes sense then.
A massive investment to control those passes like Durban and Dariel against steppe peoples. And even on a smaller scale, watchtowers and fortified villages in the Sarawak show that defensive thinking against local threats.
Does this kind of terrain favor certain tactics, like guerrilla warfare?
Very much so. Smaller, mobile groups with local knowledge can use the terrain to their advantage against larger conventional armies. We saw that with Iranian fighters using the Gilan Mountains in the 20th century, for example.
So how did these mountain peoples generally interact with the big lowland empires? It sounds complex.
It was always a mix. Resistance, negotiation, sometimes integration. But empires rarely achieved total, lasting control over mountain regions.
Why not? Just the terrain.
Terrain was huge, but also the resilience of the people. They often developed strong self-reliance, unique governance structures. The mountains were persistent frontiers, politically and culturally.
What about specific empires? The Achaemenids in Persia?
They often managed mountain groups pragmatically, incorporated them into armies, negotiated alliances, rather than aiming for complete subjugation. Similar story. They controlled many mountain areas, but often allowed significant local autonomy because direct rule was just too difficult or costly. The Sasanians definitely faced challenges from Zagros and Elbers tribes, hence fortifying the Caucasus.
And the Ottomans.
They ruled for centuries. Their control was often nominal in really mountainous areas like Mount Lebanon. They relied on local chiefs, used the millet system for non-Muslim groups concentrated in mountains, but they also faced resistance, like from Pontic Greeks or Druze. They even had a special administrative unit for the Uruk nomads in the Taurus.
And groups like the Kurds, or the communities in Mount Lebanon, they seem to have maintained a strong sense of separateness.
Yes. The Kurds in the Zagros Taurus kept their tribal structures, often pushed for autonomy, even had medieval principalities. In Mount Lebanon, the Maronites and Druze developed distinct structures, maintained autonomy, leading to that special mutasarafate status within the Ottoman system.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. How did people actually live day to day in these mountains? Water must have been critical.
Absolutely fundamental. Mountains act as water towers, capturing rain and snow, releasing it through rivers, springs, groundwater.
But you need ways to manage it, right? Especially on slopes.
Exactly. This led to really ingenious techniques. Kanats, terracing, wadi systems, often requiring major community effort to build and maintain.
Tell us about kanats.
They're basically underground tunnels, sometimes miles long, tapping groundwater at the base of mountains and channeling it gently downhill to settlements or fields. A Persian invention, brilliant for arid areas because it minimizes evaporation.
And terracing. We see that in pictures often.
Yeah, carving steps into hillsides. Creates flat areas for planting, but also controls water runoff. Stops soil erosion. You see it all over Lebanon. Yemen's Sarawat Mountains, wadi systems captured precious flash flood water. It all required organization.
And these mountain water sources fed the big rivers we talked about.
Directly. Zagros rivers are vital for Iran and Iraq. Taurus feeds the Tigris and Euphrates. Elbers rivers flow from Caspian moisture. Lebanon's limestone holds water, feeding the Litani and Orontes. Sarawat monsoon rains support local farming. It all connects.
So with water managed, what about farming on those slopes?
It led to specialized agriculture, different crops at different altitudes. Mm. And often you see this interplay between settled farmers in valleys and pastoralists moving herds.
Ranch.
Exactly. Seasonal movement. Groups like the Lurs, Bakhtiari, Kurds, Qashqai, and the Zagros had traditional summer high pastures, Yaylag, and winter low pastures, Geshlag. The Yuriks did the same in the Taurus.
What kind of crops could they grow?
A real variety depending on the location. The Gilan region near the Caspian on the Elbert slope is very fertile. Lebanon's terraces supported everything from tropical to European crops depending on height. The Sarawat had orchards, gardens, cereals thanks to monsoons. Olives, figs, citrus, grapes, grains were common staples.
Mountains also used to have significant forests, didn't they?
They did, historically much more than today, providing timber, fuel, other products, plus ecological benefits.
The cedars of Lebanon are famous.
Iconic, hugely valuable timber sought after by Egypt, Mesopotamia, which unfortunately led to massive deforestation over centuries. Only small patches like the Cedars of God remain.
Were other ranges heavily forested too?
Yes, the Elbers had the Caspian Hyrcanian forests, very biodiverse. The Zagros had oak woodlands, the Pontic Mountains too. But demand from lowlands, plus local pressures like grazing and fuel needs, led to widespread long-term deforestation.
And finally, under the ground, mountains hold minerals.
They often do. The geological processes that form mountains can concentrate mineral deposits. Mm. Copper, tin, silver, gold, building stone.
And getting them out spurred innovation.
Right. Mining techniques, smelting, metalworking, it drove development and trade. We see Bronze Age tin mining in the Taurus at Kestel, early silver production on the Iranian plateau.
Egypt exploited nearby desert mountains, too.
Extensively.
Yeah.
Gold, copper, granite, limestone, all crucial. Copper mining was big in Oman's Hajar Mountains, too, and Jordan's Wadi Fainan. Tin was scarce locally, often imported, driving long-distance trade for bronze. And the Hittites in Anatolia were early exploiters of iron ore from their mountains.
Oh. Hannah, the Chai Lady, is here. Roj Bosh, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Roj Bosh.
Let's see. Takes a sip. Hmm. This is good today, Hannah. Just right. Not too sweet, nice and warm. Excellent.
Smells wonderful. Short pause.
Okay. Refreshed. So I've covered the physical, the economic, but mountains also had this deep spiritual and mythical significance, didn't they?
Huge significance. They were often seen as, well, thresholds, places connecting the earth and the heavens, abodes of gods, sites of revelation.
So naturally, key mountains become central to major religions.
Exactly. Think Mount Sinai for Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Moses receiving the law, Mount Ararat, Noah's Ark, resting place. Hugely important for Armenians, but also in the wider Abrahamic tradition.
Mount Zion in Jerusalem, too.
Supreme sanctity in Judaism, the Temple Mount, also incredibly important in Christianity and Islam. Mount Hermon was revered way back in ancient Canaanite religions, mentioned in Hittite texts, the Bible, later linked to the Transfiguration.
And in Persia.
Yelbert.
Mount Damavand especially. Central to Zoroastrian cosmology, Persian myths, home of the Simorgh, where Feridun chained Zahak.
Even specific Islamic sites. Jabal al-Nur, near Mecca. The cave of Hira, where the Prophet Muhammad received the first Quranic revelations. Mount Uhud, near Medina, site of a key battle.
The Sinjar Mountains for the Yazidis.
Their sacred homeland, tied to their creation stories. And the Druze have Kalwat al-Bayada in Lebanon. Even ancient Anatolians worshipped storm gods like Tarhun and the Taurus. Nabataeans built high places for worship on mountaintops.
And the Mesopotamian ziggurats were like artificial mountains, weren't they?
Precisely. Trying to recreate that connection to the divine, it shows how deep-rooted that symbolism was.
Beyond formal religion, mountains feature heavily in myths and folklore, too.
Oh, yes. Homes of gods, spirits, monsters, gateways to other worlds, arenas for battles between order and chaos.
Explaining the world, basically.
Partly, yeah. Explaining natural phenomena, defining the boundary between the known world and the wild unknown, articulating ideas about good and evil.
Any examples?
Mesopotamian myths saw the Zagros as a source of wealth, but also a wild domain, maybe an entrance to the underworld. Gilgamesh mentions mountains like Mashu, Hermon, Lebanon.
Persia and the Elbers again.
Hara Berezaiti as the world mountain. Damavand as the Simorgh's home, where Zahak was chained. Powerful imagery.
Anatolia and the Taurus.
Linked to storm gods, bulls. Hurrian culture there had strong storm god cults tied to specific mountains. Ugaritic texts from the Levant mention cedars from Lebanon for the god Baal. It's woven into the very fabric of their stories.
Okay, last big theme. How did living in mountains shake the societies themselves? Governance, law, identity.
The challenging environment often reinforced tribal structures, kinship ties. That social solidarity, what Ibn Khaldun called asabiya, was crucial for survival, for defense.
Shared hardship creating bonds.
Exactly. Shared ancestry, mutual support. Mountains forged that cohesion. And tribal loyalties often transcended later state borders.
We see this with the Kurds and the Zagros and Taurus.
Very clearly. Tribal organizations shaped their economy, politics, and helped maintain a strong Kurdish identity over centuries. Same with Lurs and Bakhtiari and the Zagros, deeply tied to pastoral nomadism and tribal structure.
The Yoruks in Anatolia.
Also strongly tribal, semi-nomadic, family and tribe were core. Even the Druze and Maronites in Lebanon, their distinct identities are rooted in community, kinship, religion, all tied to that mountain refuge. Bedouin clans, too, whether in deserts or mountains, relied on kinship for survival.
Did these distinct social structures lead to different political setups? More autonomy, customary law?
Often, yes. Where state power was distant, customary law based on kinship, honor codes, local needs was vital for order. This legal autonomy went hand in hand with political autonomy and cultural distinctiveness.
The mountains helped maintain that autonomy against empires.
They acted as bulwarks, yes, allowing minorities to preserve self-governance. The Druze often had autonomy under the Ottomans, resisting when needed. Kurds constantly pushed for self-rule.
And empires had to adapt.
They often did. Ottomans used indirect rule in places like Mount Lebanon, relying on local chiefs. Persians negotiated with mountain tribes. Even modern states like Saudi Arabia or Jordan still engage with tribal structures and laws to some extent. Ibn Khaldun even theorized that new dynasties could emerge from these cohesive mountain peripheries.
So these mountain areas weren't just surviving, they were sometimes developing alternative ways of living.
Exactly. Incubators for different social, political, even religious systems. Contrasting with lowland norms of central control, state religion, settled farming.
What kind of alternatives?
More decentralized governance, tribal councils, elders, unique religious interpretations, economies based on terracing, pastoralism. These weren't just variations. They sometimes actively challenged lowland dominance.
Like the Druze and Maronites in Lebanon.
Their unique socio-religious structures, their political autonomy leading to the Mutasarafe, that's a clear example, or the Nizari Ismailis at Alamut, a whole different politico-religious system, hierarchical, esoteric, challenging the Seljuks.
The Kurds resisting assimilation.
Also fits the pattern. Mountains acted as cultural refugia, allowing diverse societal forms to survive, thrive even, adding to the region's overall pluralism.
So wrapping this up, it's really impossible to understand the Middle East without understanding its mountains.
Absolutely. They weren't just scenery. They were cradles, corridors, sanctuaries, active forces shaping pretty much everything we've discussed. History, culture, society, conflict, economy, belief. Up to 2010, their impact is undeniable.
A thread woven deep into the region's story.
And, you know, looking forward, those legacies haven't disappeared. These mountain-forged societies, their cultures, their connection to the land, they're still playing out in the modern Middle East. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What new challenges, what new opportunities might these enduring bastions hold for the future?